Mr. DeMille. I'm ready for my close-up.
I'll show up sometime. See me.
Aiden Bond! Top of the world!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hi, Wendy here. Before we start off our episode today, I want to remind everybody to check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Also, please leave a rating or comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can find us on social media by simply searching Silver Screen Time Machine, and please make sure you follow our podcast, Silver Screen Time Machine, anywhere you get your podcast. Thank you and enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome again to Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review. And today I have a guest, one of my friends, a frequent guest as well. This is the third time, I think.
Number three.
Yeah, we have Deanne back again with us. And Deanne, we are getting in our time machine and we are going back to when and we are talking about what?
We're backing up to 1965, and we are talking about the Bedford Incident.
The Bedford Incident. I personally selected this one.
It was a treat for me because I haven't seen it, hadn't even heard of it.
This is one that many people haven't seen and haven't heard of, and I think one of the nice things about doing this podcast for me is to get some of these jewels that are maybe a little more unknown out there into hopefully the world. If anybody's listening? Is anybody listening? Hopefully somebody is. Anyhow, so the Bedford Incident. What was your initial thoughts on this film?
I was excited to see it, and even after I watched it, because of all of the great actors, but usually typically character actors that were in this film that really, I think, got a chance to shine.
Right. This is kind of, I think we were talking about this amongst ourselves the other day, you kind of called this an ensemble cast. And I think you're right in a way about that. But clearly, I feel led by, it's clear that we're led by Richard Widmark in this film. He's the main actor. And matter of fact, also a producer on the film.
Yeah, he's definitely the most prominently featured actor. And yeah, I would agree. He's the main focus here.
And Richard Widmark, this is after quite a long career he had, it basically doing a lot of film noirs for 20th Century Fox in the 50s. He was kind of tied to the studio system for a period of time, finally managed to get himself free into the late 50s, early 60s. And he did form a production company. And this is one of the films that he produced. And he really wanted Sidney. Now, here we go. Here's our pronunciation issue of the day. Sidney Poitier, his friend, who he had already done two films with. So he was great friends with Sidney. I'll just call him Sidney.
Safe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll just keep calling him Sidney. But we all know who I'm talking about. There's only one Sidney.
Sidney Poitier.
Yes, that's the only one. So he was good friends with Sidney throughout his entire career. And I think even thereafter, he was friends with him most of his life. Sidney said that Richard Widmark and his wife were one of the first actors in Hollywood to welcome him into their home.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and they worked together on a very early film of Sidney's, No Way Out, which was actually a really horrible film in a way because Richard Widmark was forced to play this extremely racist character, which he did not feel that way at all, and he was horrified that he even had to play that character. Again, he's in the studio system, and he would spend most of the film apologizing to Sidney, and Sidney was like, hey, you know, you're playing a role.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie, but I have heard of it, and it's on my list of movies to take a look at.
Yeah, it's not a very lovely character he plays there, and not a very lovely character that he plays here either.
My expectations for a Richard Widmark character are, I don't expect to see him play a hero.
You're like, he is just always bad.
He's going to either be bad, or he's going to be very complicated.
Yeah. Well, he's pretty decent in Judgment and Nuremberg.
Judgment and Nuremberg being the one exception that I know about. I'm sure there are others.
So a little bit about before we get into the plot, a little bit about some of the background on this film. This film was from a novel, 1963 novel by Mark Raskovich.
Sounds good to me. Yeah, that's pretty, what it looks like.
pretty good on that one.
Mm-hmm.
So the novel by Mark Raskovich, and then the screenplay was adapted by James Poe. A really fun fact about James Poe is he has the same birthday as me.
Yay!
Yay, like that about him. And he won an Oscar for the screenplay for Around the World in 80 Days, and he also did the screenplay for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And he began his career writing for March of Time, which is interesting because if anybody listened to our Citizen Kane podcast, we talked a little bit about March of Time and what that was in that. So I thought it was interesting of the tie-in.
I have an interesting James Poe fact that I noticed today.
What is that?
He wrote the screenplay for Lilies of the Field.
Yes.
Which was a Sidney Poitier film that he won the Oscar for.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But James Poe didn't win the Oscar.
He did not.
Not for that one, at least. I believe James Poe stuck fairly close to the novel, from what I understand, except he changed the ending. And we are not going to reveal the ending. This has a very, very dramatic ending. But we are not going to tell you about it because it would really, really ruin the film. It's something you really have to experience.
We won't do that for you. But we're showing an enormous amount of restraint not talking about that ending.
We'll just say that the ending is very stunning, shocking, phenomenal. I feel like that's the way films should end. I feel like all films should end that way. But I don't think everybody would love this.
I also had read that the ending was changed, but okay. I'm not sure how much detail I can get into about what was changed without there being some spoilers.
Yeah, that's true. So we'll just say that, yeah, we better not.
Yeah.
We better not even say anything. So we'll just proceed on. Produced by Richard Widmark and by the director James B. Harris. James B. Harris was a big collaborator with Stanley Kubrick. He collaborated on The Killing, Path of Glory, and Lolita, but then they kind of had a fight and an argument over Dr. Strangelove because James Harris wanted to do it straight, exactly like he did with The Bedford Incident. And obviously, we know Stanley Kubrick wanted to make it kind of a black comedy. And obviously, Stanley Kubrick did what he wanted. And James Harris went and made this film instead, The Bedford Incident.
Another great double bill would be to take a look at that and Dr. Strangelove together and just looking at two wildly different tones on nuclear war and the Cold War era. I think it's fascinating.
Yes. And did you know that James B. Harris is alive?
I did. I happened to notice that. 95.
So, are you out there? Hello, James B. Harris. We really like your film. Okay. So the cinematography is done by Gilbert Taylor. Since we're speaking of Dr. Strangelove, he was the cinematographer on Dr. Strangelove and Star Wars Episode 4 and Flash Gordon.
Wow.
Yeah. So interesting. Very interesting. I guess they are a lot of action-based films, yeah. I suppose. So maybe.
And two black and white movies, The Bedford Incident and
Dr. Strangelove,
obviously. Yeah.
I wasn't thrilled with the cinematography in this film. I hate to be mean to poor Gilbert Taylor, but I wasn't really impressed with it.
It doesn't call a lot of attention to itself. Mm-mm. I didn't know if that was maybe sometimes a reflection of the budget, maybe budgetary concerns that, you know, you couldn't get these beautifully composed shots. But then again, I thought, well, some of the, especially at the beginning with the helicopter, they're coming down on the helicopter under the boat. To me, it sort of looked maybe a little bit like a documentary or kind of like a newsreel kind of feel where maybe that's the approach you're taking.
Yeah, and I thought we were kind of past that in the 1960s in British film, to be honest. I thought that was more a 1940s, 50s type thing. But maybe they're trying, like you said, they're trying to go back to that. I did like the music, the score. There's not really a score, but I did like the sound or the music by Gerard Sherman. He was the orchestrator on Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow.
Yeah. But I don't know how you feel, and I think this might annoy some people, but I love that sort of pinging sonar thing throughout. And I just feel like, especially when you're getting to the very big dramatic scenes, it really ramps up the tension and the suspense to me.
I completely agree. It does just add to that feeling of being very on edge.
Yeah.
And even going back to the cinematography, there are a lot of very tight shots and everybody's sort of crammed into these shots.
Yep.
And yes, the overall effect definitely, I think, set me on edge.
Yeah, there's a lot of close-ups as well. Real close-ups on everybody's faces. There's a lot of close-ups. Let's start talking a little bit about the actual plot. So what happens is it starts out, there's this helicopter that's bringing these two fellows to the ship. The fellows are Ben Munsford, which is played by Sydney, and Lieutenant Commander Chester Potter, MD, this played by Martin Balsam. That's the kind of a character actor you like to see around. He actually has an Oscar as well for 1,000 Clowns, Best Supporting Actor. Obviously, a lot of people might recognize him from 12 Angry Men. He played the foreman.
And also Psycho. He is the detective in Psycho.
Yeah, so, I mean, you see him around a lot in different films. What did you think of him in this film?
I loved him in this
movie. Did you?
I really did. He has a real standout scene that comes fairly late in the film, so I don't know that I can go into a great amount of detail with it, but there's a confrontation that he has with Richard Widmark that I thought was a joy to watch. You don't often get to see moments like that from Martin Balsam.
Yeah, so they get put on the ship. What happens is Munsford is a reporter. He asked for the assignment to be on this ship because he's interested in documenting the captain, which is Captain Eric Finlander, who is played by Richard Widmark. So Munsford and Potter come down and they're dropped on the ship, and Captain Finlander wants neither of them. He doesn't want either of them there, and he makes it quite clear that he feels that way. He's very rude to them, especially to Potter, I think more so. He clearly doesn't like the fact that Potter's been a reservist.
Yes, that comes up multiple times.
And he's very hateful towards him. He treats him very meanly, and he doesn't particularly like Munsford either, but I think we could say that Captain Finlander has a bit of an ego, and he kind of enjoys that somebody is there to do. Munsford tells him he's there to because he's interested in him specifically, and I think that sort of strokes his ego and makes him like him a little bit more. But he also doesn't want him nosing around all the time. He gets real upset about that. And he clearly has everybody in the ship on serious lockdown, and everybody has to be perfect, basically. He's got everybody on edge. Everybody's always worried about their jobs. They have to do the right thing. And he rules with an iron fist, I guess you could say. I also thought it was interesting when the doctor goes into what's supposed to be the medical area or whatever, and they're sitting there, the other medical officers, their whole job is to be looking through trash and dissecting trash instead of worrying about human ailments. Yeah. They're analyzing a piece of cabbage.
Trying to figure out whether or not it's Soviet submarine trash.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Yes, but it seems a very silly use of the medical officers, but you come to find why that's important. But when Potter comes in, he's kind of like, okay, what is going on here?
It's unusual for none of the sailors on the boat to be in there with some sort of ailment. Yeah, that's unusual.
Nobody's allowed to be sick. Nobody's allowed to be sick on Finlander's watch. But another interesting thing about the sick bay or the medical room is that we see somebody interesting in there.
Yes. One of Wendy's favorites, Donald Sutherland.
Yes, a very, very early role for Donald Sutherland. You can miss him if you're not really paying attention, because I did the first time that I saw this film. I didn't even realize he was there. He's Hospital Man Nerney is his official character name, and he's one of the ones that's dissecting the cabbage or whatever. But yeah, this is one of his early roles. Not very big role, but it's still...
But it's not a blink and you'll miss it role.
No,
either.
He has
so if you're looking for him, you will see him.
Yeah, he has numerous lines, but he's really only in that one scene, and then you don't see him again for the rest of the film. So basically, Munsford winds up trying to find out what's going on this ship, and he gets introduced to this Commodore, and you can see he's highly put off by meeting this fellow, because he's sitting there, and this is a fellow. His name is, let's see if we can get his name right, Deanne.
Oh boy, I feel
this is a toughie.
It's Wolfgang.
Wolfgang.
I feel like they were saying Schrepke. The film.
Yes.
Although, maybe shouldn't it be like Schrepka? It's German? I don't know.
I think they were saying Schrepke in the movie.
They were.
So Commodore Wolfgang Schrepke, who was a former Nazi U-boat captain in this film. And that's why Munsford is kind of like, we're associating with Nazis now. What's going on here? Captain Finlander, very deferential to Commodore Schrepke, more so than any other person. He's probably one of the few people that Captain Finlander will ever listen to.
Yes, they seem to have mutual respect for each other.
It may be because he liked the Schrepke guy was supposed to be a pretty prolific killer of allies back in the Nazi days, according to the film. And it was said that his character was actually based on a U-boat commander named Eric Topp, which he has a very simple name to say, but says during his 12 war patrols, he sank 35 ships. And only two other U-boat commanders were more successful. So that's what his character was based on, this Eric Topp, a real-life Nazi.
And I think Captain Finlander also recognizes that Schrepke's point of view is essential
right.
to this mission, because there's constantly this metaphor of the fox and the hunt. Mm. And because Schrepke has been in the mind of the pursued,
yes.
that he can maybe kind of guess what the Russians might be thinking.
And he's obviously a submarine expert.
Right.
So he's
right.
always, throughout the whole film, Finlander is directing all these technical questions to Schrepke. What can we call him? Commodore.
Commodore.
Let's just call him Commodore.
Eric Portman, the actor.
Yeah, Eric Portman. Oh, I'm sorry, but I think Eric Portman is the best thing about this film. No offense to Richard Widmark, who I really love, and Sidney is also a really great actor, but Eric Portman to me is the number one actor in this film. He's absolutely fantastic. He's just quietly menacing. I just find him. He's very quiet, and he never yells, and he never raises his voice, and he doesn't even say much. But you just have the feeling of this is somebody that could be highly dangerous if provoked.
Yes, and I had no idea that Eric Portman, this is the first time I had ever seen him in a film. I didn't know that he had been in a lot of the Powell and Pressburger movies.
And, he was a big Powell and Pressburger guy. And the funny thing is that he is British, but he's here playing a German. He also plays a German in one of his most famous roles, which is in the 49th Parallel. He plays another German Nazi person in that film as well. And that film is what sort of gave him a lot of acclaim in Britain and made him a big star. He never came over to Hollywood. He absolutely hated Hollywood. So he pretty much spent all of his career doing films in Britain. So that's why probably not as well known as some other British actors that did come over to Hollywood, but really a phenomenal actor, I think. I just think he's so good. And I think the way he and Richard Widmark play off each other is just very awesome. I think it's the best thing about the film.
I love the world-weary quality that he has.
Yeah.
He's just sort of resigned to things in life.
And but just little things like when he goes to ask the doctor for the schnapps and stuff like that. I don't know. There's just such a sense of authority, I think, in him. He's almost the opposite of Captain Finlander, who has to throw his weight around to make everybody listen to him, where he's just got this quiet authority that people just naturally listen to.
That could be. That could be.
So they're almost like yin and yang, those two together.
Yeah. I think he has almost a defeated quality, too. He's not necessarily out to prove himself in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. So they get introduced to this fellow and they find out what's going on in this particular boat is that Captain Finlander is sort of keeping an eye on these Russian ships. There's several Russian mother ships, I guess, that are regular ships. And then there's also a submarine. They call the submarine Big Red. And they're kind of keeping an eye on this Big Red to see what it's up to and trying to figure out what it's doing. And they're in what waters are they in?
Well, they're constantly talking about Greenland.
Greenland
and Iceland, somewhere in that area.
Yeah, he's kind of waiting for this submarine to go into waters they're not supposed to be in so he can make them come to the surface. And I'm not really sure. I never really understand what he's supposed to do when they come to the surface.
I think they talked a lot about deterrence. And so I think the idea is without starting World War III or an international incident of some kind, get that submarine out of that particular waters where that would pose danger for the United States.
Yeah, it says that the story reflects several real Cold War incidents between NATO and the Warsaw Pact navies, including one in 1957 when the USS Gungeon, a submarine, was caught in Soviet waters and chased out to sea by Soviet warships.
Yeah.
So I guess that's what they do. They kind of catch them in these territorial waters that they're not supposed to be in, and then they have to chase them out to the sea. I guess that's what his role is. And Munsford keeps referencing he's very good at doing this. He says he's one of the best. He gets the most results of any ship captain in the Navy. He keeps talking about this sort of thing, but then he keeps saying, but yet, even though he's getting all these great results, he was passed over for admiral. And that's why Munsford's really curious about him. He's like, well, okay, what, this guy has this great record. Why aren't they promoting him? And that's what he's trying to get to the bottom of. And I feel like Munsford is kind of almost the comic relief in this film because he does a lot of comical things. Sidney is very... His character is very relaxed and loosey-goosey, whereas you see everybody else is very severe and on edge. And he's this one guy that's just like, oh, yeah, what's up, man? Blah, 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 you
yeah,
know?
Well, you know, when you think about it, he's the one non-military person on that ship. So I think that he's kind of also maybe a good entry point for the audience into this scenario where, okay, you maybe aren't familiar with all the nautical terminology and certainly in terms of the screenplay, just have him ask the question and then you can explain it and the audience knows what you're talking about.
Yeah, so it's very clear. They keep doing these things called general quarters where I guess it's almost like a fire drill of sorts in... That's the best thing I can come up with to compare it, unless you have a better...
Yeah, it seemed like also it was practicing being ready for an emergency situation.
Yeah, almost war maneuvers, what you would do if your ship was under attack. You do these general quarters, and he keeps doing this all the time, and to the point where poor Sidney is trying to take a shower, and the water gets turned off because of the general quarters, and he has to call up the captain and say, I'm in the middle of something pretty important. Is this really an important general quarters, or can we... just get back to normal here. And yeah, so that's why I say kind of the comical relief once in a while in this film.
Yeah, one of the few places where there is a little bit of a more lighthearted tone. Yeah.
Another person that's in this film, interesting person that's in this film, is Wally Cox.
Yes.
And he plays, his name is Queffel, which is an odd name, but his name is Queffel, but is he the navigator or the person that I'm not really sure.
He's listening to those sonar pings and...
It's like he's the one tracking the sub.
Yes.
And he plays kind of an important role here. Wally Cox, he's in films here and there. He's not in a lot of films per se, or he's certainly not a big name actor. I think his best claim to fame was that he was besties with Marlon Brando.
Yeah, and I saw he also did a lot of television too.
Yeah.
Nothing I was familiar with.
Yeah, he's just a lot of little roles here and there throughout his career, but a fairly decent sized role in this film. And again, he's tracking the submarine and you just really see everybody is quite on edge. You just get that impression from all the men. There's another little man, another guy in this film, Ensign Ralston.
Oh, James MacArthur.
James MacArthur, yes. Played by James MacArthur. And he's a pretty big role in this as well. And he's somebody that, again, very on edge. He's a young guy trying to do the right thing. He's trying to impress Richard Widmark, and Richard Widmark is just hammering him. And he won't let up on him. And he says at one point, oh, he was the star quarterback and he was most likely to succeed and he was most popular. And it's almost like you get the feeling that he's kind of jealous of him having all those accolades. And that's why he even says he needs to be taken down a peg, when we all know the person that really needs to be taken down a peg is probably Captain Finlander.
Yeah, Captain Finlander isn't necessarily taking him down a peg because he's a bad sailor.
No.
The idea is, I think that Captain Finlander has a very specific idea of how you create a good sailor.
Yeah.
And it involves this sort of...
Hazing, almost.
Hazing, stressful, on edge environment. It's the only way you can approach this. Or if you don't, you're not taking it seriously enough.
This particular thing with Ensign Ralston becomes very important at the end of the film. That it comes to a very big climax. It's probably one of the most important parts of the film, which we can't tell you about. But
alas, no, we cannot.
Yes. But it really is the relationship between Captain Finlander and this Ensign Ralston is a huge part of the film, just the way he treats him and so forth. If we go on a little further with the plot, it's kind of hard because it's really a series of just following the sub, and the sub is doing things like, first of all, they do catch it in the territorial waters it's not supposed to be in, so oh, he's so excited. He's going to get to do his thing. And he radios to command headquarters, whatever that is. And they tell him, no, don't do anything. Wait. And he is infuriated. He's so mad. And he doesn't want to sit around and do nothing. So what he does is he keeps hanging around and trying to keep the sub there. And the sub is trying to navigate through a patch of icebergs. And he's also trying to navigate through the patch of icebergs. I think this had to have been a pretty low budget movie. I mean, there are a lot of scenes where you can tell this is a model ship going through. It doesn't even look remotely realistic. And you can even see a lot of times the rear projection looks very obvious to me. And I keep thinking this is 1965. We were doing better in 1950 in this stuff. What is going on with this film?
Yeah, it had to have had to do with the budget, I'd guess. But I would say, even despite the fact that it didn't seem like they poured a lot of money into that those scenes with the icebergs, I thought they were really tense.
They're tense, but they did not look realistic.
No, you really do have to kind of just give them that bit of grace that this is not your state-of-the-art CGI or practical effects.
Yeah, this looks like a little child
or whatever.
The little child has a ship in a bathtub.
Exactly. Yes. Use your imaginations, and the scenes do work.
Yeah, but there is a lot of tension there. The one thing about this film is there's a lot of suspense and a lot of tension. And again, I really hearken back to that sort of pinging sound. I feel like that really, really does such a good job. And everybody being so tense and the close-ups on the faces, I just feel like that's what really makes you feel the tension, more so even than the dialogue and the acting. It's those items, in my opinion.
Yes, because a lot of times the dialogue in this film, it's just people giving orders and jargony. And so it's not even necessarily what they're saying so much as what's behind it that's important.
I just really like almost all the dialogue that occurs between Captain Finlander and the Commodore. I just feel like everything they say to each other is just loaded with suspense, meaning, etc. It gets to the point where you can see the Commodore is trying to dissuade Captain Finlander. He's not really on the same side as him. He doesn't agree with what he's doing. Probably he's for the sub in a way because he's a submarine captain and so forth. But he also thinks that you get the impression, he doesn't per se always say what he thinks, but you definitely get the impression that he doesn't agree with what Finlander is doing and he wants him to ease up.
Yeah, I definitely feel, especially towards as the movie progresses and you're getting closer and closer to the end. And he seems like maybe the one person that Finlander might give an ear to.
Yeah, I agree. Although he did at one point listen a little bit to the, I guess, is he the first mate? The executive officer on the bridge, Commander Allison. When Commander Allison's telling him, lay off Ralston, he did sort of seem to take his opinion into account. He said at one point, you let me know if I'm getting too hard on him or something like that.
He did. And that is sort of an interesting little nuance to Finlander's character because, he's not such a hard head that he's always, you know, but it has a lot of nuance and he's complicated.
Yeah, he does certainly like to lead and be in charge and he doesn't want anybody questioning him, that's for sure. And he has this little interview at one point with Munsford and Munsford asks him some questions that he doesn't care for and he gets real irate and he gets real agitated because Munsford is asking him certain questions about his views, trying to kind of dig at him and get him to say things that he doesn't want to say, that he maybe doesn't agree with the government's opinion on things. He doesn't want to say that because he knows his job is on the line, but it's clear throughout the film when he's wanting to get the sub and they're saying don't get the sub that he does not agree with these sort of policies.
Yeah, particularly regarding the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yeah. He seemed to have made some remarks that Munsford picked up on, completely different approach. But yes, he has to be very guarded in what he says. And then that's also probably why he's very guarded around Munsford because he knows he's going to lose his job if he speaks out too much.
Yeah, and so they're tracking the sub. The sub goes under the ice, and then it gets to the point where the sub can't come up without getting caught by the ship. I mean, I'm not sure why.
At one point, they're not even sure if they still have the sub.
Right, they stop hearing the pinging. You'll hear the sonar sound, and then you hear the ping back from the sub. And then when the sub is missing, you don't hear that ping back. You can hear it on the film, so you can follow along when you don't hear the pinging. But yeah, they kind of lose the sub in the ice. when they're in the icebergs for a period of time and they don't know if it's gone, if it's not gone. And of course, Finlander is questioning the Commodore, what are the choices, what is it doing? And it comes down to eventually they figure that it's still there. It's just trying to hide and wait for them to go away.
Under an iceberg.
Yeah. But they have, obviously, there's a certain amount of air they have. So then you also have this added suspense with the clock ticking down. How much more time do they have? How much more air do they have? And it's just this waiting game where they're just waiting. What is the sub going to do? Waiting to make the next move. And this is sort of where that hunted thing comes. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to regard the sub as a sub full of human beings.
No. No, he doesn't. I'm not sure if that's just part of what makes you able to do the job, mm-hmm. is being detached from that. I think that his focus is this is a threat to the nation.
And they said that this book was also loosely based on Moby Dick, and the captain is loosely based on Ahab in Moby Dick. And there's even a line that Sidney says later in the film where he says, "You're not chasing whales now."
Yes.
That's a distinct reference to that, because that's what the character was based on, this Ahab, sort of single-minded, must get this, very single-minded, must get this sub at all costs. It doesn't matter. He can't get away from it. He can't just let it go. There also comes this part where we said Wally Cox would have another important role. At one point, Finlander does say to him, "Hey, why don't you take a break? You've been on the watch for however long." And he said, "No, no, I'm running the ship from here." But then later on, as they're going along and everything's getting real tense, he kind of has this breakdown. And this is when Dr. Potter comes in. And this is when he has that scene that you like with Richard Widmark.
Yeah. And Wally Cox, his character just broke my heart in that scene where he's having that breakdown, because you've seen him just being such a trooper the whole way through.
Yeah.
And but you almost kind of know this is probably the inevitable consequence of what these men are going through.
And this is
ship,
what the doctor was trying to tell him earlier. Your men are too on edge. He suggested they have exercise. He suggested they have mental health. And he suggested they have nutrition. He suggested all these things to the captain, and he gave him a whole slew of books to read about the ship.
Yes.
And said, mind your business, basically.
Yeah, you need to brush up on your knowledge of the submarine instead of doing this preventive doctoring that he's there to do.
So, of course, then when we see that Wally Cox has this breakdown, then, of course, the doctor feels justified. And the whole film, he doesn't stand up to Captain Finlander. You can see he's intimidated by him. But when this finally happens, he has his moment.
Yeah, it's a great scene.
Well, tell us a little bit about it.
He just basically finally speaks his mind and very forcefully says, "Look, you're pushing these men too hard. You've got to lighten up on them."
And at that point, Richard Widmark kind of gives in a little bit.
Just a little. Yeah. Just as much as he maybe ever does, yes.
Because he clearly sees, and Wally Cox's character, not only is it sad that this is happening to him, but it seems like he's so worried about disappointing the captain.
Yeah. Well, because Richard Widmark is also saying, "Hey, go do what you have to do, but I expect you to be back in 2 hours." And you just have the idea, this guy is not going to be just fine in 2 hours.
Yeah, just go take a little nap.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Take a nap. You'll be fine. But basically, that's the whole point of the movie, because when you get further down in the movie, obviously, eventually the sub does have to come up and its little top part surfaces, I guess. And they're still trying to talk to the sub, and the sub's ignoring them and not responding to him, which is making him even more angry. And this is when the Commodore starts really disagreeing with the captain, and he's saying, "What are you doing?" He at one point says, "Those are men down there," because he's like, "I'm just going to drive over the sub." And the Commodore's like, "No," he's getting as upset as the Commodore gets, which is not very upset. But he's definitely saying, "No, don't do this," almost considering him like a madman.
Yeah, he's almost provoking an attack so that he can retaliate.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And the Commodore is saying, "Hey, look," he knows what it's like to be in the middle of a war, the Commodore, and he probably thinks, "I don't particularly care to be in the middle of another world war."
Yeah.
He's trying to talk sense into the captain, but at this point, it's almost like he's gotten to the point where he's not listening to anybody. He's not going to listen. He's just decided he's after that and nothing else matters.
Yeah.
And then the end happens, which is very dramatic.
It is. The end of which we will say nothing, because you must go see this film.
You must see this film. So basically, that's most of the plot. Again, I will say it's a very stunning end. Do you have anything else you want to say about the film?
Other than it was one I wasn't familiar with, it's kind of like one of those really pleasant surprises when maybe you think you've seen all the movies of your favorites and, oh, wait, there's this one. Oh, my goodness, I get to watch another Sidney Poitier movie or another Richard Widmark movie. I love it.
Yeah, yeah, and a couple small things. Some of the scenes were filmed on a real boat. I guess we should say this film was made in Britain at Shepperton Studios.
Yeah.
The ships that the movie was filmed on were British ships. It also says a British Type 15 frigate, HMS Troubridge, where the interior scenes were filmed. If you know anything about ships, you can quite clearly see it was a British ship, even though they are supposedly Americans. And when they came down from the helicopter, this was a different ship called Type 15 Frigate HMS Wakefield. And it says it has a pennant number of F-159 clearly visible in the scene. And then the vessel that they show portraying the Soviet intelligence ship with the name Novosibirsk.
We'll go with it.
Yeah, Novosibirsk. Yeah. The thing that's funny about that is it has the name of the ship written out in English.
Right.
In English letters or
the characters.
Latin. Why would it be written in a Latin alphabet? But it should have been, obviously, Russian uses a Cyrillic alphabet.
Yeah, yeah.
So why wasn't it in
would
the
it
Russian
even have been
letters?
On the ship? Even well, I mean, when you think about it, these are military ships.
Well, it wasn't, but it was supposed to be masquerading as something else.
Oh, okay, right.
Remember, yeah. Just masquerading as a fishing vessel. But still, they would probably have used the Russian letters, not the Latin letters.
It's helpful picking out which boat is which in the shot, though.
Yes, it's obviously appropriate for the film. So, since we've gone through the Bedford incident, you know what you have to do now. We have to have our star ratings.
Yes.
So, Deanne, what is your rating on this film, The Bedford Incident?
Out of 5.
Out of 5.
I would say 3.5.
Okay. Oh, and you're notoriously high.
I am. 3.5, great, enjoyable movie. Maybe it's been done better other times in other films, but just a nice hidden gem kind of movie.
Yeah. And I will agree with you and say 3.5 because although I really enjoy this film, I really, really like Eric Portman. I can't talk enough about how much I love the job Eric Portman does in this film. He's a phenomenal actor. I wish he had had more roles that were well known. And I also really love Richard Widmark too. But the ship and the sea, I mean, it's so low budget looking. And this is 1965. We can't do a little better even on a low budget. I feel like this could have been so much better, to be honest. But I will say that I really appreciate, I guess you can't call it the music, but the sound in it. I think that's just genius, the way they do that sonar and that pinging, and it just ramps up the tension. This is very suspenseful. This has a very amazing ending. This is the way films should end, in my opinion. As far as the acting and the suspense and the sound and the ending, that's all really marvelous. I just wish they had somehow done a little bit better, even with their budget, to try to make it look slightly more realistic.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
I think that about wraps it up. And I would like to say, again, thank you to you, Deanne, for coming on and being a wonderful guest, as you always are.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Wendy. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll see you back soon again. And for Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review, we are saying goodbye. Thank you for listening to our podcast today. Please don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. And please leave us a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Intro and outro music composed by Heidi Engel. Artwork by Tyler Birch. Produced and edited by Wendy Wittick. Recorded at PCTV Studios, Pittsburgh, PA. See you next time.